Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome. I am Teal Brown. I'm with the Aspen Institute, and I am truly honored to be here to introduce Carolyn Porco, who is the leader of the imaging team on the Cassini Science Mission, which is currently, as many of you may know, I believe, orbiting Saturn. She's a leader in exploration of the outer solar system, and I won't go on further about her because she's far more interesting than anything I can say about her. So without further ado, Carolyn Porco.
Well, thank you very much for, I'm happy to be here, so thank you for inviting me. I hope this is gonna be the first of many Aspen Ideas festivals that I come to, because I'm having a tremendous time. I feel like I have led a charmed existence to have been born and to have grown up at a time when I did, which was when our nation first stepped off our planet and became a spacefaring nation. I was just a young girl growing up in New York City when we were sending back pictures, the first pictures from the moon, from Mars, and from Venus, and they were published in the newspapers of New York, and I was, you know, looking at them, all grainy as they were. I was a teenager by the time Neil Armstrong first stepped on the moon in 1969. I was a young graduate student at Caltech in Pasadena, California, when we first landed on Mars in 1976 with the Viking spacecraft. And I was a senior graduate student when we first, when the Voyager spacecraft, which toured the outer solar system in the 1980s, made their way past Saturn. And as a newly minted PhD, I became a member of the Voyager imaging team and participated in humankind's first explorations of the planets Uranus and Neptune in the late 1980s. And now I'm in the extraordinarily privileged position of being a participant in one of the most dazzling interplanetary endeavors we have ever undertaken, and to be leading the team that is taking our images presently of Saturn from Saturn orbit. And I've said many, many times, I've got the best job in the inner solar system. These missions of exploration that we have been conducting over the last 50 years, I think you would agree, if you gave it a moment's thought, are part of a very much larger human quest. And this is a quest to come to understand something of our own origins and to get a sense for how our Earth, our planet, and we have come to be. And one of the most promising places that we could go to in search for answers to these questions is the planet Saturn, because of, and shown here, of course, with its largest moon, Titan. And the reason for that is because out of all the planetary systems that we currently, well, that we will ever have available to us in our solar system, Saturn's, with its very complex subsystems, if you will, of magnetospheres and atmosphere and rings and moons and so on, all of those interacting in complex ways, offers the ideal destination for study of many of the same physical processes that we believe occurred in the formation of the solar system and in its present-day dynamics and in the dynamics of solar systems that we are discovering around other stars. So aside from offering tremendous scientific insight into the origins and development of our solar system and other systems throughout the cosmos, and aside from offering, as you can see, striking beauty and splendor beyond compare, this is a planetary system whose exploration offers enormous cosmic reach. We had, of course, been to Saturn before in the early 1980s with the Pioneer spacecraft, and then soon after that with the two Voyager spacecraft. But our exploration of Saturn began in earnest and in exquisite detail when, in the summer of 2004, the Cassini spacecraft glided into orbit around Saturn, and at that point became humankind's farthest robotic outpost that it had ever established around the sun. And so I'm going to take you this morning through this. I'm going to show you this part of this grand voyage that we've been making for the last 50 years. That is, I'm going to take you on a tour through the Saturn system as it is currently being revealed to us by the Cassini spacecraft. And to give you a sense, and a decidedly visual one at that, you're going to see nothing but pictures, for how this very major exploratory expedition that we are presently, as I speak, conducting around Saturn is unfolding. Now, the first obvious example of enormous cosmic reach are Saturn's rings. The rings are, of course, what makes Saturn the icon of planets in our solar system. They are tremendous. They extend 280,000 kilometers across, and at that size, they would fit in nicely between the Earth and the Moon. And they consist of countless colliding bodies. These are bodies made of ice, water ice, predominantly water ice, and they range in size from the size of the finest powder you might ski on here in Aspen to the sizes of small apartment buildings. They orbit Saturn all in the same direction. They're screaming around Saturn at 20 to 40,000 miles per hour, but they only very, very gently jostle one another. Millimeters per second are their relative velocities. I've heard people describe the inside, you know, what it would be like to be in Saturn's rings as if comparing it to a beehive. It would be nothing like a beehive. It would be more like traffic on a freeway. All the cars screaming past, but they really don't move relative to one another very quickly. This is what physicists call a very equilibrated system. So any violent collisions in this system died out a long time ago. And because of that, they are very, very thin. They're paper thin in comparison. Only several stories in a modern-day building. In fact, if you look at them edge-on, they practically disappear. And bear in mind that despite their visual enormity, if you took all the mass in Saturn's rings and pushed it all back together to make a moon of Saturn at the proper mass density, it would be no bigger than this little moon Enceladus here, shown here. So a tremendous visual spectacle for comparatively little mass. And I want to point out, in case it's not obvious, that these bands that you see in the northern hemisphere are the shadows of the rings cast on the northern hemisphere of the planet. The processes that are ongoing in Saturn's rings are believed to be the same processes that occurred in the disk of material that ultimately became the solar system. Here's an artist's rendition of the protosolar nebula. In similar disks around other stars, here's a picture of a disk taken with the Hubble Space Telescope around an M dwarf star in our galaxy. It's the most common star in the local solar neighborhood. This star is only 32 light years away from us. This disk is 40 billion miles across and is believed to be similar to the disk that we had around our sun when the sun was as young as this star is. And then reaching a trillion times larger in size, the processes ongoing in Saturn's rings are believed to be the same as those ongoing in the systems of stars and gas that we call the spiral galaxies. In fact, the physics and the mathematics that were used to describe and explain the spiral structure in spiral galaxies was co-opted, and with very little change, it was a significant change, but nonetheless, it was a very small change, was used to predict that when Voyager got to Saturn in the early 1980s, it would see structures that were similar to the spiral arms of galaxies, and that's exactly what happened. So there is a great deal to be learned in studying just the rings of Saturn about other systems throughout the cosmos, about the early stages in the formation of planets, and so on. and that's exactly, you know, just one of the reasons why we wanted to go back to Saturn with a spacecraft as sophisticated as Cassini. Now, the rings themselves exhibit an enormous variety of structures. The structure was discovered by the Voyagers in the early 1980s, and most of it is still unexplained. Although we are, over time and over the 3 years now that we've been in orbit, we're beginning to get glimmers of understanding of what is going on inside the rings. Here is a natural color view that we had of the rings on approach before we got into orbit. The resolution here is about 15 kilometers a pixel, so that means the tiniest dot that you might see in this picture is about 10 miles across, so it gives you a sense of scale. From the ground, from the Earth, we knew there were three major elements, A, B, and C. We get to, you could tell they were different from each other from the ground. We got an even stronger impression of that when we arrived there with Voyager. The outer A ring is pretty transparent. That is, it casts shadows on the planet, rather dim shadows. The structures in here are all driven by the gravitational perturbations of moons, and I'm going to show you a lot of that. The B ring is the densest portion of Saturn's rings. It casts the deepest shadows. Lots of structure in here. This is almost all of it is internally generated. It's structure that just apparently occurs when you stick particles in orbit around a body, all colliding with one another, and what they do together as a system as a result of their own gravitational attractions on each other. The C ring is even more transparent than the A ring, and it has these plateau features, very sharp-edged features. Much of this we're still trying to understand how it all comes about. There may be that each of these ring elements had a different origin, and that's not clear yet either. Now, Saturn is very far away. It's 10 times farther away from the Sun than the Earth is. And Cassini at launch was very, very massive. It was 6 metric tons at launch. And even launching it on the largest launch vehicle that we had in the American arsenal at that time, the Titan IV missile, strapping onto that solid rocket motors to give it extra boost, and putting Cassini on top of that stack and then on top of a Centaur upper stage wasn't enough to get it directly to Saturn because it was so heavy. So it was looped around the inner solar system for 2 years, picking up speed by flying by Venus twice, by the Earth once. These are gravity assist maneuvers where you steal a little bit of momentum and energy from the planet, the orbiting, the moving planet, and give it to the spacecraft, so it gives you quite a an extra increase in velocity. And then finally, we passed it by Jupiter for the same reason, a gravity assist maneuver, on the eve of the year 2001, which I thought was tremendously poetic. And all of this for a final push to Saturn to arrive in the summer of 2004. Now, the object of this exercise, as you can imagine, is to get the spacecraft to its target as quickly as possible so that those of us who are involved in the space in the mission are still alive by the time the spacecraft gets there. And that means that by the time we got there, we were screaming by, and we actually had to slow the spacecraft down in order to capture it, actually allow it to be captured into orbit. Okay, and that meant that was done in a maneuver where more than half of the launch mass of the spacecraft, which I told you was 6 metric tons roughly 3 metric tons was fuel that was expended in this maneuver to slow the spacecraft down. During this maneuver, we flew over the rings closer than we'd ever been before in previous missions, closer than we'll ever get again in the course of this mission, and maybe even in our lifetimes, depending on when we return to Saturn. And you can imagine the scientists were very, very eager to make use of this maneuver to collect data on the rings. The engineers were cautious. If we didn't get into orbit, the whole mission was ruined. So they were, you know, nerve-wracked by the idea that we would even want to touch the spacecraft during this maneuver. This discussion went on for about a decade. I'm not kidding, for about 10 years. And then finally, they said, okay, the reason won out, and we were allowed to turn the spacecraft with our instruments pointing down during this maneuver. And we collected the most exquisite high-resolution images, as I said, that we'll ever see in the course of this mission. And it's a collection of images we're still, 3 years on, still busily examining. One thing we saw a lot of during this time were waves. Okay, we flew, by the way, over the dark side of the rings. Nonetheless, sunlight shines through the rings, and so we can see structures. The finest dot, a dot in this picture is several football fields across. Okay, so we've gone from the previous picture where it was 15 kilometers or 10 miles. Now it's several football fields across. And these are waves. These are the kissing cousins of the spiral structure that you see in galaxies. Okay, this is a density wave. This is a place where the orbits of the particles have become eccentric because of the gravitational perturbation of a moon. And those non-circular orbits are phased in such a way as to give you lanes of higher than average concentrations of particles which spiral around the planet. If you were to follow one of these lanes, these dark lanes, that would be bright on the lit side of the rings, you would find that they spiral all the way around the planet. So here it's the eccentricities of the particles that are being excited. Here it's the inclinations. Here the ring takes the form of corrugated cardboard, and it's the inclinations of the orbits of the particles in orbit around Saturn that get phased in such a way as to give these structures. We saw waves upon waves, because there's lots of perturbations from moons on the particles in Saturn's rings. On the day side, after we crossed the ring plane and emerged on the day side and looked back and took pictures, we saw more wave structure. Here the resolution is coarser. It's about 1 kilometer per pixel. nonetheless, you see these waves now, the crests look bright because you're on the day side, lots and lots of waves. And also you see this corduroy-like structure. All of it is produced by the gravitational interactions of orbiting moons. Now, one remarkable and very telling discovery we made in this impressive collection of images was to the presence of these propeller features. This is the highest resolution image we took during that collection on the dark side. This now has a resolution of about 52 meters, half a football field is a tiny dot here. These structures are about 3 kilometers across. You could easily walk 3 kilometers in less than an hour. So that gives you a sense of the scale here. And these are propeller features that are really incipient gaps being made in the rings by larger than average ring particles. In fact, the particles here are several times bigger than the particles that are of are most common, I should say. Okay, particles in the rings tend to be about 20 meters across, 10 meters across. Here we think they're about 60 meters across or 100 meters across. Okay, and they're producing gaps in the rings. And so this discovery is pointing to the presence of bodies within the rings that, as I said, are bigger than your average ring particle, and it's telling us something about how this system of particles has evolved over time. Now, there are even bigger bodies embedded within the rings which are having even more dramatic effects on the surrounding ring material, again, through their gravitational perturbations, and this collection of images taken during the Saturn orbit insertion maneuver has given us some stunning examples of this. This is the outer edge of the A ring right here. This is the famous F ring, which is shepherded by the moons Prometheus and Pandora. We've seen lots of structures in this over time. It's just a feast for dynamicists who want to understand how rings and moons interact. This is the outer edge of the A ring. This is the Keeler gap. It's about 30, 40 kilometers across. I'll come back to that in a minute. This is the Encke gap. It's about 300 kilometers across. That's roughly the size of Colorado. Okay, and you could see in it a little moon. This is a little moon Pan. We knew of Pan's presence before Cassini got there, but we're very eager to study what Pan does to this gap. Okay, the next picture is a close-up region taken during the Saturn orbit insertion maneuver, and here it is. You could see these diffuse ringlets, and you can also see what Pan does to the edges of this gap. It makes these undulations. Okay, these are eccentricities in the particles on the edges of these gaps that are being excited by the perturbations of Pan. You could see these streamers moving away from the edge. These, again, are higher than average concentrations of particles made by the effects of Pan. Okay, and this is a close-up we've gotten since, not taken during the Saturn orbit insertion maneuver, but you could see Pan is 30 kilometers across, so it protrudes above and below this very thin ring. And then we also, one of our objectives is to search for other moons in the rings, and Cassini made this discovery. This is an 8-kilometer moon in the Keeler gap that I pointed out to you, right at the edge of the A ring, which is here. And this moon is doing the same thing. It's raising waves in the edges of the gap, again, through its perturbations, its gravitational perturbations. Now, these systems, these dynamical systems of a moon in a gap in a disk of material are the best nearby analogs we have in our solar system for the systems that we are discovering routinely now throughout the galaxy. And that is disks of dust and gas around other stars in which we can tell are embedded growing planets. And the study of the manner in which moons like Pan and Daphnis open their gaps and maintain the ring material at bay through their gravitational perturbations is proving and will prove very useful for understanding how a planet, let's say Jupiter, growing out of the solar nebula, little by little, accreting matter onto it, finally comes to truncate its own growth by opening up a gap in the rings, in the solar nebula, and preventing material from falling onto it. So again, we're developing from what we're finding with Cassini, we are arriving at insights for other dynamical systems throughout the cosmos. One of the main objectives was with Cassini was to determine the physical characteristics of moons like Daphnis and like Pan to see if they could tell us something about the evolution of the ring system and the formation of the moons themselves. And recently we've done just that. In fact, this is work that's going on in my shop Over the last 3 years, we've accumulated enough information about their sizes, their shapes, their masses, their densities. We've done this for Pan and Daphnis. I forgot to say that I wanted to back up first and remind you of what our common wisdom is for how rings come about, and that is that they come about, we think, from the catastrophic disruption of a pre-existing moon that was close enough to Saturn that once it got smashed up, the material could not coalesce back into a moon, but got spread out as a disk of material around Saturn, and then through subsequent collisions and erosions, the particles came to be in the particle size distribution. They came to have the particle size distribution that we see. And so we wanted to see if we could look at the moons in the ring region to see if there was some hint that we were correct about this. And as I said, now we have enough information. We have enough information now on Atlas, which is a moon outside the outer edge of the A-ring, looking very much like a flying saucer here. And then a moon like Pandora, which is one of the F-ring Shepherds, bigger in size, 80 kilometers across. But what we've been able to tell now is these moons do not look like they themselves are the collisional remnants. They don't look jagged. They don't look like you would expect just something bashed up to look. They look like moons that have been accreted. So what we think is that if there are any leftover remnants of the original body, progenitor body for the rings, it is buried at the heart, at the core of these bodies. But these are bodies that apparently grew from accretion. Speaking of moons, Saturn is accompanied by a very large and diverse collection of them. They range in size from just a few kilometers, a few miles across, to Titan, shown here, which is as big across as the U.S. When last I counted, some 57 moons of Saturn. There's probably more now. They're being discovered all the time. The moons of Saturn fall into two groups. There's an outer group that is some 10 to 20 million kilometers away from Saturn, but there's the inner group, which exists or orbits within about a few million kilometers of Saturn. It's that collection, the inner collection, that has been the focus of Cassini. And this group is all mostly made out of water ice, is believed to have formed from a nebula of dust and gas and material that orbited Saturn, analogous to that which formed the planets around the Sun. And so our goals in studying the Saturnian satellites were not only to come away with measures of their compositions, their densities, their sizes, and so on, not only to advance our understanding of the geological processes that have occurred on these bodies over the 4.5 billion years of the solar system, but also to look at them with an eye towards testing and refining our ideas about the formation of solar systems, both our own and those that are presently being discovered. The Cassini tour through Saturn, through the Saturn system, is absolutely unprecedented in scope. In four years, it calls for 82 close satellite flybys. Okay, 44 of those are made of Titan, because Titan is the gravity assist body for us. We fly by Titan to alter the direction and the inclination and so on of Cassini's orbit around Saturn. And then the rest of those flybys are a collection that is better than any flyby we ever did with Voyager, and then a smaller collection, a handful of them, are exquisitely close, where we flew over the moons as close as the space station flies above the Earth. Okay, and the year 2005 was a year I call the year of the moon, because we conducted most of our very close flybys in that year. And as a result of that, we've discovered some remarkable things about the moon's geology and physical characteristics and so on. And we've also returned some startling pictures. Did you have a question?
It looks as though the big moons are not in the orbital plane.
No, they are. It's an illusion that's created by looking at a system where the bodies are strewn over very large distances, and you're looking at it just slightly tilted. They're all in a plane, pretty much in a plane. Anyway, some of our outstanding images I'm about to show you. Here's Tethys. This is a moon that's about 1,000 kilometers across. We just had a recent close flyby of Tethys. Not a really, really close one, but That was just last week, in fact. You could see it sports some very large basins, and here it's shown with the rings in the background. Here is Rhea, about 50% larger than Tethys, shown hiding coyly behind the rings. I know my team and I are responsible for these images, so we're biased, but I think they are just spectacular images alone. They're in danger of putting the space artists out of business. They're so captivating. Here's Dione, shown against the disk of Saturn. This moon is a little bit smaller than Rhea, so about the same size as Tethys. Here's a close-up of Dione. This is a skyline view. You're looking at a picture here that's about, the resolution is about 100 meters, so the finest thing you see here is about the size of a football field. Or this picture, which is a closer view of that. Okay, it's just gorgeous, showing the very fresh ramparts of these craters, the central peaks of craters. You couldn't resolve an astronaut in this picture because it's about 100 meters per pixel, but I look at that and I just think it's crying out for astronauts to be crawling on the surface. Here's our Death Star, Mimas, about 400 kilometers across. You're looking at a picture here. This is about 2.5 times smaller than Dione. And then here's Hyperion, which has got to be the strangest looking body we've ever taken a picture of. This is about 200 or 300 kilometers across. We just yesterday issued a press release about this picture because today we have coming out in the journal Nature a paper that explains why Hyperion looks the way it does. We thought initially this was a thermal effect where dark material perhaps accumulated in the bottoms of craters and therefore caused more evaporation of ice. We're talking of processes that go on over billions of years. So things that might seem implausible, if they go over billions of years, they can actually have a dramatic effect. So we thought this was a thermal effect caused by the uneven sublimation of water ice. It turns out that it probably looks this way because it is very underdense. It's about half the density of water, so it's very porous inside, and the craters are very barrel-shaped or conically shaped because of the way craters are made in underdense material, and more by the material being pushed, you know, squeezed and compressed rather than blasted out. And also because the density is so low, the gravity is so low, the ejecta tends to escape rather than come back down on the body and soften the appearance of the craters. So it's not anything as exotic as some exotic thermal effect. It's actually a confluence of some very ordinary things that has made Hyperion look the way it does. But for a body its size, it truly got the strangest looking surface. And then, of course, there's Iapetus. This body is about the size of Rhea, so it's about half the size of our own moon, and we find just some fantastic geology on this body. This is the body that half of which is as dark as you can get in the solar system, and the other half is white. Okay, this was recognized by astronomers in the 17th century, and we now have investigated it with Cassini. I don't have the time to tell you all that we've learned about these moons, but this picture, I don't know. The resolution here is, in fact, I'm not even sure what the resolution is. It's certainly a kilometer per pixel or better. For scale, this is a cliff that is 15 kilometers high, okay? And this is a landslide, if you could call it that, at the base of a cliff. So, and this is a body, as I've said already, is largely made of water ice. So you can imagine someday, it might very well be that your great-great-grandchildren will be taking Virgin Galactic to Iapetus to spend their vacations climbing the ice cliffs of Iapetus. And I envy them. So anyway, as I said, I don't have the time to go through everything we've learned about the moons, but two of the moons have been standouts so far in the Cassini mission, and those are Titan, which is Saturn's largest satellite, is 50% larger than our own moon, and Enceladus, which is a tenth the size of Titan. Now, Titan has long captivated planetary scientists. Before Cassini got there, it was the largest single expanse of unexplored terrain that we had remaining in our solar system, and was believed to have a surface environment that was more similar to the Earth's than any other body in the solar system. Like the The Earth's its atmosphere is largely molecular nitrogen, so it's like the gas that you're breathing in this room. Like Earth's atmosphere, it has a mild greenhouse effect going at the bottom of its atmosphere, so its surface environment is some 20 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it would be without its atmosphere. But its atmosphere lacks free oxygen, and it is suffused with small quantities of organic matter like methane and ethane and propane and so on. And for all these reasons, Titan's atmosphere had come to be thought of as an analog, or at least the best analog that we had in our solar system, for the kind of atmosphere that scientists believe existed on the Earth before the emergence of life. So we were very excited about the prospects of exploring Titan. And that's not all. These organics form a ubiquitous haze around Titan. They give Titan its orange color. And before Cassini got there, it was believed that these haze particles, over time, over eons, they would grow. They'd fall down to the surface and coat the surface in an organic sludge. And some of these compounds, methane in particular, can be liquid at the surface of Titan, despite the cold of 300 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, which is what the temperature is there. In fact, what water can do on Earth, methane can do in the Titan environment. It can be a solid, it can be a liquid, or it can be a gas. And so all of this opened up a very bizarre world of possibilities. You have an envelope around Titan, a globe enshrouding 200 kilometers thick of red smog, making the Titan days very eerie and dark. High noon on Titan is as dim as deep Earth twilight is on the Earth. You would have patchy methane clouds floating above an icy surface. In places, you might have gentle rains of liquid hydrocarbons, gentle because the surface gravity is low, so that the rains would fall very slowly. And they would fall to the surface, and they could cut gullies. They would wash the organic sludge off the highlands. They would form rivers and cataracts. They could carve canyons. And they would fill in basins and craters and low-lying depressions. So just stop and imagine what this environment would be like. You're standing on a moon in the outer solar system. 200 kilometers of haze is above you. It's impossibly cold. It's dark. It's eerie. It's misty. And before you is Lake Michigan brimming with paint thinner. Okay, that is what we thought might exist under the haze of Titan before we got there, and actually you will find that we weren't that far off. So Titan's atmosphere is indeed very extensive, and you can see here it backlit from by the sun, and you could see haze layers in the north polar region, and this is just a gorgeous image. This is why I wanted to show it, with the rings in the background and another moon. Despite its dense atmosphere, though, several instruments on Cassini have the ability to see down to the surface. We got smart after Voyager. We figured out the trick of how we could look down and see the surface. My cameras were outfitted with special spectral filters that allowed us to see down to the surface. If you look in the infrared, it's actually more transparent than in the visible. And also, Cassini carries a radar instrument, which is virtually identical to the instrument that mapped the surface of Venus in the early 1990s. Venus is the planet that's in the west right now. It's that very, very bright object, and it's very bright because it's completely covered in white clouds. So radar is the way you can investigate a surface when you have a thick atmosphere in the way. And this is what we saw. Okay, this is what we saw in our images. This is a global view of Titan. And looking more closely at this region, you can see bright and dark regions, okay? And if this doesn't make a lot of sense to you, don't feel bad, because it didn't make a lot of sense to us either when we first saw these pictures. It was very hard to make sense of them. Remember, it's always hazy on Titan. There are no shadows. So if there are no shadows, it's very difficult for us to tell what's up and what's down and what topography there is. That's a feature of remote sensing in planetary science. Is you look at on airless bodies, you look at shadows to deduce topography. There are no shadows. So we know from subsequent investigations and information from other instruments that the dark regions are low-lying and the bright regions are higher, maybe up to a kilometer higher, but mostly about 100 meters. You could see things that look like sinuous something or other, wasn't clear. You see some circular features. There's something that we know is an impact crater. You don't see a lot of impact craters here. Tells you immediately this is a young surface. Okay, it has been, certainly it has had the same hailstorm of debris falling on it over 4.5 billion years, but its surface has been reworked tectonically, or else it's the craters have been obliterated by deposition, but nonetheless, it's a young surface we're looking at. And then here's the other side of Titan. Okay, again, the same thing, bright regions, dark regions. We didn't know what we were looking at. These, by the way, are clouds. We do see a few clouds here and there. We weren't sure what this was and what was up and what was down at the time we first saw these pictures. So we were planetary explorers, and like explorers from long ago, we find something new, we name it after something that looks familiar to us. So we started calling this Great Britain. This became Iceland. This became France. This became Iberia. This was Peloponnesia. The geography is not quite right, but we didn't care. But still, it wasn't quite clear. It was just very difficult to interpret these images. There were no unambiguous patterns, geological patterns that we could say, aha, it looks just like something we see on the Earth. Therefore, the process that makes it must be the same. We were just bereft for an explanation. And then a remarkable event happened, and this was an event that we all anticipated would be the Rosetta Stone for interpreting our images that we were taking from orbit, and that was about 6 months after getting into orbit came what many regard as the highlight of Cassini's investigation of Titan, and that was the deployment of the European Huygens probe. And this basically is a flying saucer-shaped device that was carried by Cassini across interplanetary space for 7 years and was deployed to Titan and successfully drifted down through the atmosphere on a piece of fabric and through the hazy atmosphere and came to permanent rest on its surface. This was in mid-January 2005. And this, I can tell you, was a positively, it was an emotional event. It was a positively extraordinary achievement, and it was not lost on us during this event, which was monitored from Darmstadt, Germany, which is the European Space Operations Center, that this was history in the making. It's what I've gone around calling a grown men crying kind of day, because that's exactly what it was. It was people were losing it. Some people were disappearing into corners so they wouldn't get busted by their colleagues. Some of us didn't make it into corners. We got busted anyway. And this was the day that humankind landed a device of its own making in the outer solar system. It was science fiction becoming a reality. And it was, in my mind, an event of such significance. It should have been celebrated, you know, across the U.S. and Europe with ticker tape parades in every major city. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. But it was extraordinary, actually, for another reason. And that was that the celebratory presentations, again, we were in Darmstadt, Germany, the celebratory presentations during this event were given in German accents and American accents and English accents and French and Dutch and Italian accents. And it was, you know, I sat there in the audience listening to this and thinking what a moving demonstration it was of what the words United Nations are really supposed to mean. And that is a union of nations joined in a common cause. And in this case, it was a massive undertaking to explore and to come to understand a planetary system that for all of human history had been unreachable, and now it had been touched by our kind. And it was a remarkable day and one that I'm not likely to forget, and you shouldn't forget it either. Yes?
You've got three vehicles there, it looks like. Can you explain what each of them are?
Three vehicles? This is, yeah, it just came apart like a Russian doll, you know. This is the orbiter. This is the actual probe that was this is actually the bottom. There's a heat shield on the bottom, but this was the top of the probe that was pulled off. This was the final stage of its, actually maybe it was, I don't know which parachute it is. It came down on several parachutes.
What's the yellow part above the heat shield?
This? That's the upper part that was pulled off.
That's the instruments. Are there instruments in that?
This is outfitted with 6 instruments that took measurements of the Titan atmosphere as it fell down to the surface, and there was a surface science package that measured the properties of the surface after it landed. So I'm going to continue. I'll never get done in time. Anyway, so as I just said, it took many measurements on the way down, and it had a camera, and it spun as it fell. And this camera took panoramic images, okay? And, of course, we were all just breathlessly waiting for the first images to come from this event. And it's impossible to say what it was like to see these first images. And I'm just going to show you the first images that were shown to the public and to all of us. It was actually this is a large mosaic, but it was a picture taken 16 kilometers up showing what we'd all longed to see from orbit. And this was a completely unambiguous pattern. It's a drainage pattern that could only have been formed by a flowing liquid. Okay, and you can even trace the sinuous channels in this drainage pattern, and they all tend to flow down. In this particular area, they flow down to this region here. So this, right away, was determined to be about 100 meters high. In fact, in subsequent images, stereo allowed the scientists to determine it was 100 meters high. This, by the way, was taken by the Huygens imaging team, not our imaging team. So this is 16 kilometers high. It looks like a drainage pattern. We didn't know this is a shoreline, therefore. Okay? What kind of shoreline was it? We didn't know at this point. 8 kilometers altitude. This is a picture that was taken. It's also been colorized. You could see closer, more closely, what this looks like. These look like offshore islands. A very dramatic picture. Now, bear in mind, 16 kilometers, 8 kilometers, okay, that's roughly airliner altitude. If you were to fly in an airliner from LA to New York, you would be flying at something like 10, 11, 12 kilometers altitude. So this is the picture you would have out the window of Titanian Airlines as you flew across the surface of Titan. And then finally, the probe came to rest on the surface. And so here is the picture. This is landfall in the outer solar system for the first time in history. And this is the horizon. These are about so big. They're almost certainly water ice. So think of them as water ice stones or pebbles. And this is a dark, flat region. The Huygens came down in one of those dark regions that we were seeing from orbit. And it landed essentially on the Titan equivalent of a mud flat. This is an unconsolidated ground that was suffused with liquid methane and very likely made from the accumulation, as we had surmised, of billions of years of organic matter being washed off highlands and ending up in the low-lying regions of Titan by seasonal rains. More or less, like I said, what we had surmised. So all in all, the Huygens part of the Cassini mission was a glorious triumph and gave us, in fact, the ground truth that we needed to interpret the images that we were taking from orbit. But still, at this point, this is early 2005, we didn't see, either in our images or from the Huygens images, we didn't see any open bodies of liquid hydrocarbons like we had suspected. And still, the exploration of Titan continued, of course, and the Cassini radar, in fact, made an interesting discovery in the equatorial regions of Titan. I don't know how I get rid of that. Anyway, it discovered dunes. This is hundreds and hundreds of kilometers worth of dune fields extending for something like 1,200 kilometers across the surface in the equatorial regions. They're several kilometers apart, about 100 meters high. And this tells us that first of all, they're longitudinal dunes, which means they form in the direction of the winds, which means you need a bidirectional regime of winds. Winds have to come from two directions, okay, over time. And it also tells us that you have to have dry enough conditions to loft particles on Titan. So right away, we see that there's tremendous diversity, geologic diversity. This is a major geological feature we found in the equatorial regions of Titan, but still no lakes, no open bodies of hydrocarbons, until finally we got to look in the polar regions of Titan. And this is a picture that was taken in June of 2005. It is a picture taken with our cameras, and it's the closest we had seen at that point to something that looked like a lake. Had the shoreline, the morphology of a lake. It was very dark. And also this region, that's the pole where the Red Cross is. So this whole region is dotted with similar looking bodies, if you will, not as big, but the same. Looked to us like it might be kind of a lake region of Titan, but we didn't know for sure because this is all the information we had. Okay, yes?
When you say lake, are you talking about a methane lake or some such material?
The only material that can be liquid on the surface of Titan is methane or ethane, actually, but there's not much ethane. There's a little bit of ethane. It's mostly methane. So the candidate for this was methane, but we didn't have any other information to say until in February of this year, Cassini flew over the North Pole, or North Polar region of Titan, and both our experiment and the radar experiment collected data, and this is what we found. So sorry I can't get rid of that hand. Oh, I can get rid of that hand. Okay, anyway, these are a large structure, body, whatever, that looks again like the features we saw in the south. This is about as large, if you scaled it up to the Earth, about as large as the Mediterranean Sea. And this is the overlain radar data. And you could see very, very dark radar imagery here. And the radar team has interpreted this as liquid hydrocarbons. It's the most plausible explanation for why they would get absolutely no echo whatsoever from these regions. And now we're just going to take a pan across the polar region as imaged by the radar team. And you could see lots of other smaller bodies that look similar, again, analogous to what we had seen in our images in the South Pole. So it appears that the liquids on Titan have migrated for some reason or exist at the poles of Titan, at least during the present season, which is southern summer. You could see all these other lake-like features, and preferentially located near the poles. And why this is, we don't yet know. It's apparently telling us something about the meteorology of Titan. But I think that you can see what we have found on Titan is a very exotic and alien body, but also very familiar in its geological processes and formations. And because of that, promises us the hope of comprehension. And it is tremendously geographically diverse, in fact, more geographically diverse than other bodies that we've seen in the solar system outside the Earth. And so we'll see a lot more of Titan over the next 3 years, which is how long we expect the Cassini mission to go on for. But in this tale of two moons that I'm telling you about, the next is Enceladus. And Enceladus is a small airless body. It's very bright. It's very white. It's no bigger than England or Great Britain. This is not meant to be a threat. Just trying to show you how small Enceladus really is. And despite its size, what we have found on Enceladus with Cassini has completely thrown us for a loop. Here is a picture, a Cassini picture taken at about 1 kilometer per pixel. You can see it's very, very white. This is a false color image. We've tried to pull as much color out of this thing as we possibly could. Okay, and you can see these stripes in the... this is the South Polar region, so there are places where it's somewhat colored. I'll say more about that in a minute. But looking at a resolution that's 10 times better than this picture, you can see that it does not look like the other moons in the Saturnian system. It is not pockmarked with craters. Okay, it is also, therefore, a very young surface. That's what it tells us. It's been geologically, tectonically wrecked. Okay, it's got systems of fractures and faults. They cross each other at wild angles. It's got deep chasms, mountain ridges, and so on. A very young geologic surface. But the motherlode of discoveries on Enceladus was found at the South Pole. So here's a close-up look at the South Polar region. The South Pole is about there. This is a contiguous chain of faults that circumscribes the whole South Polar region and actually separates it from the rest of Enceladus. Here are these fractures. We call them the tiger stripes because from afar they look like the stripes on the back of a tiger. Again, this is false color, okay? And Enceladus is almost pure water ice except for these regions here. And they're colored in pictures like this because they are coated with organics. That is why they look the way they do. So we have these fractures. They're coated with organics. And another very strange discovery was that this whole region was elevated in temperature. Okay, it was hotter than the rest of Enceladus. So this is as bizarre as finding that the Antarctic on the Earth is hotter than the equator. Okay, so the plot thickens. And finally, the thing that really was tremendously exciting was when we put Cassini in a particular orientation with respect to the South Pole of Enceladus and with respect to the sun, that is looking back in the direction of the sun, this is what we saw. We saw jets of fine icy particles issuing from those cracks. We know this now. They issue from those cracks tens of kilometers above the South Pole of Enceladus. And when you take a picture like this and you colorize it in order to bring out the very faint light levels that you can't see easily in a black and white picture, this is what you see. And you could see that these jets feed a plume. They feed a gigantic plume that extends tens of thousands of kilometers above the surface of Enceladus. Cassini, during July of 05, actually flew through this plume and measured its composition, the gaseous component of this, and measured water and organics. Okay, so now we're drunk with excitement because we have, you know, the analysis of all this information and the analysis of pictures like this by my team and others on the Cassini project has suggested that the jets are coincident with the warmest places on those fractures, and that they may in fact be geysers issuing from subterranean pockets of liquid water. Okay, and so if we are correct about this, I've said a million times, we've just stumbled upon the holy grail of modern day planetary exploration. This is an environment that has potentially liquid water, has organics, and has excess heat. And to put it another way, it's an environment that is potentially suitable for living organisms. And I don't think I need to emphasize to anybody really what the discovery of life elsewhere in the solar system, should that ever happen, what it would mean, and that it might have enormous implications. Because if we could demonstrate that Genesis had occurred not once, but twice in our solar system independently, then that means, you know, it's occurred a staggering number of times throughout the cosmos in its 13.7 billion year history. I'm not saying we've done that and we have a lot of investigating to do with Cassini, but this has certainly turned out to be one of the most exciting, tantalizing discoveries that we have made. And Cassini continues to orbit Saturn and is returning, you know, picture after magnificent picture. And I'm sure you understand the value of pictures and images and the culture-shifting ability that pictures have. Our space program has led the world in taking such images, and I'm just going to remind you of a few of them, pictures that have become cultural icons. Those of you who were alert and coherent during the 1960s will remember this one, which was taken in December of 1968. It was the first image of Earth, whole image of Earth from space, and one that had an enormous effect on our perspective of our place in the cosmos and our responsibility for the welfare of our own planet. This image has been credited with providing great impetus to the environmental movement, among other things. And about 9 or 10 months ago, whatever it is now, I'm very proud to say that we caught with our Cassini cameras the sight of something again that no human had ever seen, and that was a total eclipse of the sun seen from the other side of Saturn. And you can see in this picture the backlit image, the backlit rings. The sun is behind Saturn. You can see the refracted image of the sun, and you can see this beautiful blue ring that encircles Saturn, which is in fact the result of the exhalations of Enceladus and its particles that are going into orbit around Saturn. And as if this weren't brilliant enough, within this lovely scene, you can capture a glimpse of our own planet from across a billion miles of interplanetary space. And I can tell, you know, as evidenced by your reaction, there is something very deeply moving about seeing the sight of our own planet in the skies of other worlds. I can't think of anything that has greater power to alter our perception of ourselves in the cosmic scheme of things. And that changing mindset and that changing worldview may in the end be the greatest legacy of all our interplanetary travels and the finest reward that we'll ever receive on this hopefully never-ending journey that we began some 50 years ago. Thank you. Okay, so questions? Yes?
Why hasn't this been on the front page?
Good question. Good question. I don't know. It has been on the cover of the National Geographic. It has been on the cover, I think, of Discover magazine. But I just don't understand why we're not getting more press in mainstream media. If you would ask a mainstream media person, they say it's got to be news. It's got to be,
This is news.
Huh?
You've got one back here.
Okay, so we have, yes. You want to answer him? When we, that did make the front page.
Okay.
When we said that there might be water, it did make the front page. In fact, I got the quote of the day. It's, I'll never be as famous again, the New York Times.
But this image itself, showing the earth, I mean,
I've come to think that the moral, social, cultural, spiritual, scientific, psychological education of every child on earth should begin with this picture. But I'm biased. Yes.
When are you going back to Enceladus?
When are we going back?
Yeah.
Well, we are in orbit around Saturn, and we are, yes, we are. We're going to do a terribly close flyby next March. We're going to, this is making the Cassini project and the engineers very nervous, but we're going to be flying 25 kilometers above the surface of Enceladus at the pole, at the equator. So that will take us about, I think, 100 kilometers over the South Polar region, which is what we want to do. And we are planning right now, we're planning the extended mission for Cassini, and there are a handful of Enceladus close flybys that we're going to do, simply because it has now emerged as, this very significant discovery. Yes?
As you discover new bodies, why do you always name them Greek and Roman names?
There are themes for naming the bodies and even craters and so on in the solar system for each planet. And I couldn't tell you what they are. This is handled by a group called the International Astronomical Union. I think Michael wants to answer this. Do you want to answer this?
That is the answer. There's this body, and they have, you should go to their website. It's iau.org, I think.
Yeah, so there's, we have to keep in that theme to get bodies named. So, Daphnis, we named Daphnis. We named three of the other moons that we discovered. They were all part of, Greek mythology. There's a different mythology they're following for the outer moons. They're doing something else. But there's a theme. And if you want to name something after a person, that person has to be dead for 3 months, 3 years. 3 years. There are, yeah. So, yes?
You've got an awful lot of science, though. And I wonder how you react to the amount of science that you can do unmanned versus some of the stuff you read about sending men back to the moon.
Well, yes, you're right. I recently wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times about this issue, and actually, even though I have been for my whole career thick with the robotic side of NASA, I actually came down in favor of sending people back to the moon and Mars. It is absolutely true that the human side of NASA, the human space program, has been moribund for 35 years. We've done nothing, essentially, and it was basically because of a poor political decision back during the Nixon administration to cancel the greatest vehicle we ever had for launching things into space, and that was the Saturn V. And with that, we lost the ability to send people to other places, and so we've been going around and around in circles. I think I think it has to be a balanced program. Scientifically, I even think it has to be a balanced program, because eventually people are going to be places in the solar system at outposts conducting scientific research. And there are things that people can do that spacecraft can't. We can do an awful lot with robotics. And at this stage in the scientific exploration of the solar system, robotics is clearly what we want to do. But at some point, humans will be able to trump what robotic spacecraft can do. So eventually humans will have to be, will be, in the throughout the solar system. And my shtick is, well, when are we going to start? We should have continued 35 years ago on the track that we were with Apollo, and we didn't. So I think it's important to have a balance. You know, robots are always going to have to precede humans. You're never going to want to send humans anywhere where a robot hasn't been to find out the environment is safe, or we have to worry about A, B, and C. And also, it's undeniable. We may not like it. People who are, you know, dedicated to the unpiloted or the robotic program of NASA may not like this, but the public just, they're far more jazzed for some reason of seeing humans in space. Okay? It's probably the identity. They can identify more with seeing someone walk on the moon or seeing someone walk on Mars. And I have to say, it does the same to me. You know, so I think it has to be a balanced program. I think what NASA is doing now, except they're not given what we consider enough support from the administration, but what the plan they have in place now is a good one. The idea was to take the funding that was already allocated, historically allocated to the human flight program, and use it to turn the ship around and, you know, develop the capability to send humans to the moon. The problem is it is making incursions into financially into the robotic side of the house, because NASA is not being given the budget that it really needs. But its budget is tiny in comparison. Always remember that. We talk about how expensive it is to explore space. A $17 billion annual budget for NASA, it's a tiny agency in comparison to everything else. My thing is, you could double the NASA budget and I bet it would go unnoticed. Yes.
As far as the water, what sort of range of temperatures might you expect from that?
Well, you have to have temperatures as warm as 0 degrees Celsius in order to. Well, that was what's so surprising. We're in my community now, and on my team throughout the Cassini project, we're all running around like chickens without heads, trying to understand how did Enceladus get this way. Well, there is, because the main source of energy wouldn't be solar, it would be tidal flexing. Enceladus is in an eccentric orbit, it's being flexed, okay, and that will heat up its interior just by the same process that Io, the moon around Jupiter, is warmed by its flexing. So Enceladus is warmed by flexing, but that's not the full story. It's more complicated than that.
Effectively, things that have carbon floating around in areas in a liquid form where things can start happening. Are we kind of prioritizing our evaluation of these based upon our expectation of water-based
Absolutely.
Organic suits, as opposed to, say, thinking from the standpoint of weird stuff that happens from evolution, for example, the deep depths of the ocean, that there are things that happen where the whole, you know, the concept of you've got
Even at the bottom of the ocean, even at the bottom of the ocean, you need water as a, you know, a medium. Okay, this is a very complex issue.
Yeah.
I think your question boils down to the simpler question, which is, why are we so focused on water?
Yeah.
Okay, why isn't it ammonia? You know, why isn't it the system of silicon and ammonia instead of carbon and water that we're looking at? And basically, you got to put yourself in our shoes, okay? How do we tell? How can we tell we've got something that's living? Scientists can't even decide what life is. If you asked two scientists who study what are the criteria for deciding this is a living organism or not, you can't get them to agree. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but there are disagreements as to what even you would consider living. Okay, so how do you know you found something living? How do you know you found a fossilized form of something that was living? It's a very difficult problem. So basically, NASA has taken as its guideline, follow the water. Okay, where there's water, you know, the best thing we can do right now, the simplest thing we can do right now is try to find life that we are familiar with, that we have some chance of recognizing. So that's basically why we get all excited about water. And there's plenty of water in the solar system in various forms, ice in the outer solar system. So we think there's a chance. Okay, you and then I'll go.
When you land with the little module, I take it does not move. Sorry.
Which little module and which landing?
Huygens.
The Huygens?
Right.
Oh, it was not a rover. Yes.
Okay, is it still bright? Is it still sending you images?
Oh, no. It was, it only lasted, it had a battery, and it only lasted for a few hours.
And with respect to the spacecraft, seeing you're in orbit, do you direct it to give you pictures at certain intervals, or is it always feeding back information?
Well, it's always feeding back information, but it feeds back information because we have spent years and years and years planning each minute of the timeline. Okay, every minute of Cassini's time has been planned by scientists having teleconference calls deciding what are we going to do? Where are we going to point now? I want this time. No, you want that time. Well, I don't want you to have that time. I want this time. And
so
okay.
It's being directed.
Yes.
And with respect to that, how long does it take for the image that's taken to get back?
Something like an hour and 10 minutes, an hour and a half, depending on where Saturn is in its orbit. Yeah, it's a very sophisticated spacecraft. Voyager was actually, for its time, very sophisticated. It was the first spacecraft that could actually be somewhat autonomous. In case it got into trouble, it was programmed to do certain things. You have to do that when the light travel time is so fast, you know, because the reaction time, the reaction time would be no shorter than 3 hours in a case like this. Not really. The gyroscopes that keep Cassini position where we ask it to go, you know, orient yourself this way, and one or two of them are getting arthritic, you know, but actually it's just been a fantastically functioning spacecraft. There's been no big problems with it whatsoever. Yeah, so, yes.
I was at your first, when you were on the panel, with science, the media, basically, and I'm not what I consider a science geek, and I'm in the same basic thing. I watched Atlanta on the Moon and everything else. I couldn't understand why they killed the program in 71 and so forth. And there's a real, it's real difficult. I'm going to put a little bit of blame back on NASA and on you and JPL. It's difficult to find information. Now, since the advent of the Internet, it has become possible, and it is becoming better and better. But NASA's website and JPL's website is still basically difficult to work. And I would love to see this speech.
Go ahead.
You know, I'll be able to click on this, but of course I need a high-speed internet. I would love to see this speech and watch it in the afternoon and, you know, all my Cassini things and so forth. There are things that you can do from your side to take people who are more or less, in my case, who are interested but not, you know, into it all the time and put that information out there more.
Well, this is a touchy subject. Because it's just a touchy subject.
The rovers have been my favorite. I mean,
yeah.
And there's a JPL rover update once a month. There should be one once an hour. You know, I mean.
There are. I think there is on the. Is this being recorded? I'm always worried about that.
Yes, assume it is. Yes.
Okay, then I'll be cautious. You know. There's politics involved in this question. There's also finances. I would love to, if I told you how much money I had to make images, to produce pretty pictures, get them out there, you would die. I mean, it's just pathetic. It's like a half a person I have, you know, half an FTE, you know what I'm saying? And it's just, we're doing this on a shoestring budget, so we haven't been given a lot of money. I would love to, I wanted to take our Jupiter images, the images that we collected flying by Jupiter and make them into an IMAX movie, okay? But this stuff requires time, it requires a lot of funding, and we don't. And NASA, certainly there isn't funding for that kind of activity. And so I agree with you that probably we're not getting information out enough or as coherently as we should. There is on the JPL Cassini website, there is, I believe, a Cassini update. But it's.
What I'm trying to say is one's causing the other. Without the lack of information, you're not getting the public support that's causing the funding.
But do you think that's true even for the human flight program? It seems they don't have to. There's more information. Michael, maybe you have some comment on this. Does the human flight program get out more information than we do?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Yes. That's exactly right. Yeah. Anyway, I hear you. I hear you. I just, at some point, there's limited resources. There's only so much you can do.
I mean, maybe you should take the rovers and send them to jail for a week. Opportunity had to go to jail for driving drunk or something. That might get
you.
The demise. Oh, yes, I'll come back.
I'm just sort of curious on that line if there's opportunities. I mean, if is all this stuff available? Have there ever been opportunities for outside NASA groups to use the information to try to get it out in their own sort of business model or nonprofit model? Or, I mean, you can imagine a sort of Google Earth of.
I'm talking to Google right now. You're right. Everybody's talking to Google.
The question is, like, you know, if you can imagine some creative solutions to the exposure problem if the data was publicly available.
It is. It's publicly available in raw form. Mm-hmm. But really, you know, to do it right, you have to have the people who are in the know for how to do it, you know, participating. And okay, so I guess we have to. Yes. Did you want?
One last question. You said earlier, maybe I misunderstood, that this was going to go on for another 3 years.
The non.
Is
that
the lifetime of the spaceship, or is it your financial support?
Okay. The how long? As I said, Cassini is very robust. We're not having any problems with it that would, you know, limit its lifetime. No serious problems. It does have a fuel on it that we use to kind of turn the spacecraft hither and thither a little bit. I mean, you know, by small degrees. And we need that fuel in order to take images so we can target things. So depending on how parsimonious we want to be with that fuel, we could go on probably for many years. But it is amounts to a financial thing. So the nominal mission ends next summer. That would have been 4 years in orbit, and then we've already applied for an extended mission of 2 years. And although the stamp hasn't been stamped yet, we're pretty much certain we're going to go on for those extra two. So that means an extra 3 years from now. And then after that, or during that time, we'll apply for another extended mission, and it's just going to be a kind of leapfrog thing to see how long it goes on for.
Is there an outline of the kinds of questions that you began with and the iteration of those questions? With next questions, and all of a sudden, as we get information, we're asking other kinds of questions, and that's part of this mission extension. Take a second, and what are the kinds of things that you are asking now that you didn't ask when you played?
Oh, like what? How did Enceladus get the way did it get? What we want to see the rest of Titan. Titan has turned out to be so geographically diverse. We want to be able to map all of it. So that's going to take more time because at the end of the nominal mission, the radar instrument, for example, won't have seen the whole surface, so they want to continue to see the surface. We want to examine the changes in the rings over a longer time baseline because, the longer the time baseline, the more precise you can measure the rates at which things are changing, and that will tell us something about how long rings evolve. So there has been this evolution in our thinking, of course, over time. And we have been asked by NASA to do that. I mean, this is not, even though to me it's a slam dunk, they put us through, you know, our paces. We have to go to them and say, this is what we found with Cassini. this is why it is vital for us to maintain operations in orbit, and these are the science objectives we want to address. So, yes.
It hasn't been much on Saturn itself. It's all been about the systems around it. Can you just speak to that?
Well, I only have so long to talk, and I try to do the big highlights,
yeah.
But we'll make this the last question. But we've discovered lots of things about the Saturnian atmosphere. There's a hurricane-like storm at the South Pole. Voyager actually discovered a hexagon at the North Pole. But we've got a better look at it with Cassini. We've discovered storms that live and die, so we've seen the full life cycle of storms. Something that's a little bit maybe detailed, but we've now found that small eddies can feed the jets on Saturn. We didn't know if it was the other way around. The small little storms you see, were they coming off the jets or were they feeding into the jets? So now we find that they feed into the jets, and tells us that the jet streams are maintained on Saturn, and we know already on Jupiter and on the Earth, by the same mechanism. They feed by eating up smaller storms, and that's how they're created. So we are finding things about them. I just don't have the time to stick it all in an hour talk. Anyway, thank you very much for coming.